The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 1, continued. Cassette 8, Side 1.
Thereupon, Memoirs of a Trustee by Dyakov appeared. Memoirs of Survival. Complacently confirming their resourcefulness in getting well fixed and cleverness in surviving at any cost. And this is precisely the sort of book that should have appeared before my own. In those few short months when it seemed possible to discuss, a certain amount of debate flared up about the role of the trustees, and a certain general question was raised of the moral position of the trustee in camp. But in our country, they do not permit any information to be X-rayed through and through, nor any discussion to encompass all the facets of a subject. All this is invariably suppressed at the very beginning, so no ray of light should fall on the naked body of truth. And then all this is piled up in one formless heap covering many years, where it languishes for whole decades, until all interest and all means of sorting out the rusty blocks from all this trash are lost. And so it was that all discussion of the trustees was dampened down at the very beginning and passed out of the pages of the public press into private letters. And the distinction between a trustee and a slogger in camp, though no sharper than that which existed in reality, had to be made, and it was very good that it was made right at the very birth of the camp theme in literature. But in V. Lakshin's censored article, there was a certain excessiveness of expression on the subject of camp labour, seeming to glorify that very thing which replaced machines and created us from the apes. And the generally correct direction of the article, and to a certain extent my own novella as well, were met with a counter-wave of indignation, both from former trustees and from their never-imprisoned intellectual friends. What's going on here? Is slave labour being glorified? The cinder-block-laying scene in One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. What's going on here? Since when does earn your bread by the sweat of your brow mean do what the gulag chiefs want you to? We, trustees, are particularly proud that we avoided work and didn't drag out our existence at it. In answering these objections right now, I only regret that they will not be read for some time. In my opinion, it is unworthy of an intellectual to be proud of the fact that he didn't descend to physical slave labour, you see, because he was able to get into office work. In this situation, the Russian intellectuals of the past century would have presumed to boast only if, at the same time, they could have liberated their younger brother from slave labour as well. After all, Ivan Denisovich didn't have that way out, fixing himself up with an office job. So what should we do about our younger brother? Is it all right to let our younger brother drag out his existence at slave labour? Well, why not? After all, we've been letting him do it long enough on the collective farms. We even fixed him up with it there. But if we let him do this, then maybe, at least once in a while, for at least an hour or so on occasion, before knocking off, when the masonry work has gone well, we can let him take an interest in his work. We, after all, even in camp, find a certain enjoyment in sliding the pen along the paper, in drawing a black line on tracing paper with a drawing pen. How could Ivan Denisovich get through 10 years if all he could do was curse his work day and night? After all, in that case, he would have had to hang himself on the first handy hook. And what, then, can one say about such an unlikely story as this? Pavel Chulpenyov, who had worked at logging for 7 years in a row, and at a penalty camp at that, could hardly have survived and kept working if he had not found meaning and interest in that logging. Here is how he stood it. The camp chief, who took an interest in his few permanent workers, a surprising camp chief, in the first place fed them belly full with gruel, and in the second place permitted only his record-holding shock workers to work nights in the kitchen. This was their bonus. After a whole day of logging, Chulpenyov went to wash and fill the food pots, stoked the oven and cleaned potatoes until 2 a.m., and after that ate his fill and went off to sleep for 3 hours without taking off his pea jacket. Once, also as a bonus, he was allowed to work for 1 month in the bread-cutting room, and he rested up another month by self-mutilation. Because he was a record holder, no one suspected him. And that is all. But, of course, Explanations are required here, too. In their work gang was a woman thief, a veteran bazaar swindler, who worked for a year as their dray woman. And she was living with two trustees at the same time, the weighing-in checker and the warehouse manager. As a result, their work gang always overfilled its norm, and more important, their horse, Gerchik, ate all the oats he wanted and hauled well. Other horses were rationed according to the work gang's norm fulfillment. I am sick of saying, poor people. At least here I can interject, poor horses. But nonetheless, 7 years on logging without interruption, it is almost a legend. But how could you work for 7 years if you didn't work well, if you didn't find some meaning in it, if you didn't become absorbed in the work? All they had to do, said Chulpenyov, was to feed me, and I would have kept working and working. That's the Russian character. He mastered the technique of continuous felling, felling in such a way that the first branch supported the trunk so it didn't sag and was easy to trim. And all the subsequent trunks were dropped atop one another, crisscross, so the branches fell neatly into one or two bonfires, without having to be hauled away. He knew how to pull a falling tree in exactly the required direction. And when he heard from the Lithuanians about Canadian lumberjacks, who for a wager would put a stake in the ground and then drive it down into the ground with a falling tree, he was filled with enthusiasm. All right, we'll try the same thing. And it worked. And that is how it turns out. Such is man's nature that even bitter, detested work is sometimes performed with an incomprehensible, wild excitement. Having worked for 2 years with my hands, I encountered this strange phenomenon myself. Suddenly you become absorbed in the work itself, irrespective of whether it is slave labor and offers you nothing. I experienced those strange moments at bricklaying, otherwise I wouldn't have written about it. At foundry work, carpentry, even in the fervor of breaking up old pig iron with the sledge. And so surely we can allow Ivan Denisovich not to feel his inescapable labor as a terrible burden forever, not to hate it perpetually. Well, as I see it, they will yield on this point. They will yield to us, but with the obligatory condition that no reproaches should be implied for those trustees who never spent even a minute earning their daily bread by the sweat of their brow. Whether by the sweat of their brow or not, they at any rate carried out the commands of the gulag bosses diligently, otherwise off to general work, and painstakingly using their special skills. After all, the significant trustee positions were essential links in the camp administration and in camp production. These were precisely those specially forged, skilled links in the chain without which, if every last one of the Zeks had refused to accept trustee positions, the whole chain of exploitation would have broken the entire camp system. Because society outside could never have supplied such a quantity of highly skilled specialists who were willing in addition to live for years in conditions unfit for dogs. So why didn't they refuse? Why didn't they break the magic chain? The trustees' positions were the key positions for exploitation, norm setters, and were their bookkeeper helpers much less guilty, the construction superintendents, and were the technicians so guiltless themselves? What trustee position did not, in fact, involve playing up to the bosses and participating in the general system of compulsion? Was it only as cultural and educational section instructors or as godfather's orderlies who did the devil's work? And if N worked as a typist, solely as a typist, yet typed out requisitions for the administrative section of the camp, did this mean nothing? Let us think about that. And if she ran off copies of orders, this was not for the good of the Zeks. Let's suppose the security officer had no typist of his own, that he himself had to type out his formal charges and the final version of the denunciations of free persons and Zeks he was going to imprison the next day. But you see, he could give this material to the typist, and she would type it up and keep silent, without warning the endangered person. Yes, for that matter, would not a low-ranking trustee, the locksmith of the camp workshops, have to fill a requisition for handcuffs, or strengthen the grids of iron bars in the punishment block, Or let us stay among written materials. What about the planner? Would not an innocent planner aid and abet planned exploitation? I do not understand. In what way was this intellectual slave labor purer and nobler than physical slave labor? So it is not Ivan Denisovich's sweat we should be getting most upset about, but the peaceful pen scratching in the camp office. For half my term, I myself worked at a Sharashka, one of those islands of paradise. We were torn away from the rest of the archipelago. We did not see its slave existence. But were we not exactly the same sort of trustees? And did we not, in the very broadest sense, by our scientific work, strengthen that same Ministry of Internal Affairs and the overall system of repression? And this problem goes beyond the bounds of the archipelago. Its scale is that of our whole society. Have not all our educated strata, technologists and those trained in the humanities, been for all these decades precisely the same kind of links in the magic chain, the same kind of trustees? Can anyone point out to us scholars or composers or cultural historians, among even the most honest of those who have survived safe, sound and whole, and who flourish, who have sacrificed themselves to establish a common life in disregard of their own? And is not everything bad that goes on in the archipelago or on the entire earth accomplished through us? Yet we attacked Ivan Denisovich for laying bricks. More of our bricks are there than his. In camp, they more often expressed the contrary insults and reproaches, that the trustees rode on the sloggers' backs, devoured their food, survived at their expense. These charges were made against the compound trustees in particular, frequently not without grounds. Who short-weighed Ivan Denisovich's bread? Who stole his sugar by dampening it with water? Who kept fats, meat, or good cereals from the common pot? Those camp compound trustees on whom food and clothing depended were chosen on a special basis. To get those positions, impudence, slyness, bribery were required. To hold such jobs, ruthlessness and a deaf ear to conscience were required, and in most cases to be a stool pigeon as well. Of course, all generalizations overstate their case, and from my own recollections I can undertake to name opposite examples of uncorrupted, honest compound trustees. But they didn't last long in their posts. As far as the bulk of well-fixed camp compound trustees are concerned, however, one can say without fear of being wrong that on the average more depravity and malice were concentrated among them than in the average native population. It was not a matter of chance that these were the very jobs the camp bosses gave to their former cronies, imprisoned former security people. When the MVD chief of Shakti district was imprisoned, he wasn't sent to cut timber, but popped up as work assigner at the headquarters camp of Usulag. And when MVD man Boris Guganava was imprisoned, because I once took a cross off a church, I have never since known any happiness in life, he would be the manager of the camp kitchen at Reshoti station. But another, seemingly quite different breed, latched onto this group, too. The Russian interrogator from Krasnodon, who under the Germans had conducted the case against the Young Guard partisans, was an honored work assigner in one of the divisions of Odzelag. The genuine content of this case, it seems, was vastly different from even the first version of Fadayev, but we will not put our faith solely in camp rumors. Sasha Sidorenko, a former intelligence agent who had fallen into German hands right off, and who had gone to work for them right off, was now storeroom manager in Kengir, and loved getting back at the Germans there for his own fate. Hardly had they gone to sleep after roll call, tired from the day's work, than he would come to them pretending to be drunk and raise a heart-rending cry. "Germans, Achtung, I'm your God, sing to me!" And the frightened Germans, rising up on their bunks half asleep, began to sing Lily Marlene for him. And what kind of people were those bookkeepers who released Loschilin from camp in late autumn, wearing just his shirt? For his surprising, or too ordinary, fate, see below Part 4, Chapter 4. Or that shoemaker in Burepolum, who, without even a twinge of remorse, took Ernst Bernstein's new army boots in return for a bread ration. When they got together on their porch for a friendly smoke and a chat about camp affairs, it was hard to picture just who among them might be different.
True, they too have something to say in justification of themselves. For example, I.F. Lipai wrote a passionate letter. The prisoner's ration was outrageously and pitilessly plundered on all sides. The thievery of the trustees for their own sake was petty thievery, while those trustees who engaged in larger-scale thievery were forced into it. The administration officials, both free workers and prisoners, particularly during wartime, squeezed the poor of the division officials, and the division officials did the same to the camp officials, and the latter did the same to the storeroom and kitchen personnel, and all at the expense of the Zex ration. The most fearful sharks of all were not the trustees, but the non-prisoner chiefs, Kuragin, Poisoy Chapka, Ignachenko from Sevdvinag. They did not just steal, but remove from the storerooms, and not just by the pound, but in sacks and barrels. And again, it wasn't only for themselves, they had to divvy up. And the trustees had somehow to cover all this up and forge the records. And anyone who refused to do it was not only sacked from his job, but sent to a penalty or strict regimen camp. And so the trustee staffs, by the will of the chiefs, were riddled with cowards afraid of physical work, and scoundrels and thieves. And the only ones ever prosecuted were storekeepers and bookkeepers, while the chiefs kept out of it. After all, it wasn't they who signed the receipts. And the interrogators considered it a provocation for storekeepers to testify against bosses. The picture is quite vertical. It so fell out that a woman of my acquaintance, Natalia Milevna Anichkova, who was honest in the extreme, was once assigned to manage the camp bakery. At the very beginning, she ascertained that it was customary to send a certain amount of baked bread, from the prisoner's bread rations, outside the camp compound daily, without any documents, of course, in return for which the bakers received a small amount of preserves and butter from the shop for the free employees. She forbade this system, stopped the bread leaving the camp compound, and immediately the bread began to turn out underbaked or rock hard, and then the batch would be late, this from the bakers, and then they began to withhold flour from the warehouse, and the camp chief, he had been getting more out of this than anyone, refused a horse to fetch and deliver. Anichkova struggled for so many days, and then surrendered, and at once the work went smoothly again. Even if a compound trustee was able to keep out of this universal thievery, it was nonetheless nearly impossible for him to desist from using his privileged position to get himself other benefits, such as rest point out of turn, hospital food, the best clothing, bed linen, or the best place in the barracks. I do not know and cannot picture a trustee so saintly that he never grabbed the least tiny bit of something for himself from all those benefits strewn about. And his fellow trustees would have been afraid of him. They would have forced him out. Everyone, even though indirectly or in a roundabout way, even though almost not knowing, nonetheless made use of these benefits, and in some degree lived off the sloggers. It is hard, very hard, for a compound trustee to have an unsullied conscience. And then there is another question about the means with which he got his position. Very rarely was it a clear-cut question of qualifications, as for a physician or for many work trustees. The unobjectionable path was to be an invalid, but frequently it was the protection of the godfather. Of course, there were apparently neutral ways to get there. People got positions because of old prison connections, or thanks to collective group support, often based on ties of nationality. Certain of the small nationalities were successful at this and used traditionally to cluster in trustee jobs, and then the communists used to help each other out privately. And there was another question, too. When you were raised up, how did you conduct yourself toward the rest, toward the common herd? How much arrogance was here? How much rudeness? How much forgetfulness that we were all natives and that our power was transient? And finally, the highest question of all. If you were in no way harmful to your brother prisoners, were you at least in any way useful to them? Did you ever use your position, even once, to defend the general welfare? Or only and always on your own? As far as the work trustees were concerned, it would be quite unjust to accuse them of eating the sloggers' food or riding on their backs. The sloggers weren't paid for their labour, true, but not because they fed the trustees. The trustees weren't paid for their work either. Everything went into the same abyss. But the other moral doubts still remain, the virtual inevitability of exploiting advantages in living conditions, the not always clean ways of getting the right assignment, arrogance. And then always that same question at the top. What did you do for the general good? Anything at all? Ever? Yet there were some who could, like Vasily Vlasov, look back on deeds on behalf of the universal good. Yes, such clear-headed smart fellows who managed to get around the arbitrary camp rules, who helped to organize the common life so not all would die, and so as to deceive both the trust and the camp. Those heroes of the archipelago, who understood their duty not in terms of feeding their own persons, but as a burden and an obligation to the whole prison herd. The tongue simply cannot be twisted to call such as these trustees, and most came from the engineers, and glory to them. But for the rest, no glory. There is no reason to put them on a pedestal. And there is also no reason for the former trustees to be contemptuous of Ivan Denisovich, because they succeeded in sidestepping all kinds of slave labor and did not lay bricks by the sweat of their brow. Nor is it worth arguing that we intellectuals expend twice as much energy on general work, on the work itself, and then by a sort of psychic combustion on all the mental activity and suffering, which we simply cannot stop, and as a result of which it is fair for us to avoid the general work. And let cruder types slog away. It is still not clear whether we do in fact expend twice as much energy. Yes, in order to abstain from coming to some sort of an arrangement in camp and let the force of gravity take over and drag you down to the bottom, one must have a very stable soul, a very illumined consciousness, a large part of one's term behind one, and probably, in addition, regular parcels from home. Otherwise, it is straight suicide. As the gratefully guilty old camp veteran D.S.L. blank V. put it, "If I am alive today, that means someone else was on the list for execution in my place that night. If I am alive today, it means that someone else suffocated in the lower hold in my place. If I am alive today, it means that I got those extra 7 ounces of bread which the dying man went without." All this is written not in reproach. The basic viewpoint of this book has already been set forth and will be held to until the end. All who suffered, all who were squeezed, all who are forced to make a cruel choice, ought rather to be vindicated than accused. The more correct thing will be to vindicate them. But in forgiving oneself the choice between dying and being saved, do not forgetfully cast a stone at the one whose choice was even harder. We have already met such people in this book, and there will be more. The archipelago was a world without diplomas, a world in which the only credentials were one's own claims. The Zek was not supposed to have documents with him, including educational records. In arriving at a new camp, you yourself would invent who you would make yourself out to be this time. In camp, it was advantageous to be a medical assistant, a barber, an accordion player. I daren't go any higher. You would get along all right if you were a tinsmith, a glass blower, or an automobile mechanic. But woe on you if you were a geneticist, or, God help you, a philosopher, a linguist, an art historian. Then you had had it. You would kick the bucket on general work in 2 weeks. More than once I dreamed of declaring myself a medical assistant. How many writers and philologists saved themselves in the archipelago this way? But each time I could not make up my mind to it, not even because of the superficial examination. Knowing medicine within the limits of a literate layman, yes, and having a smattering of Latin, somehow or other I would have bluffed my way through. But I found it awful to picture myself giving shots without knowing how. If there had been only powders, syrups, poultices, and cupping, I would have tried it. Having learned from my experience at Novi Jerusalem that being a commander of production was repulsive, when I was shifted to my next camp at Kaluga Gates in Moscow itself, right at the threshold, at the gatehouse, I lied, saying that I was a norm setter. I had heard that term in camp for the first time in my life, and I had not the faintest idea what norm setting was, but I hoped it was along mathematical lines. The reason I had to tell my lie right there at the gatehouse, on the threshold, was that the site chief, Junior Lieutenant Nevezhin, a tall, gloomy hunchback, came to question the new prisoner transport right away, then and there at the gatehouse, despite our arrival at night. He had to decide by morning who was to be sent where. He was that businesslike. With a distrustful stare, he sized up my officer's breeches stuffed into my boots, my long-skirted overcoat, my face lit up with eagerness to serve, and asked me a couple of questions about norm setting. I felt I had replied skillfully, but I realized afterward that my first two words had exposed me to Nevezhin. And in the morning I was not taken out to work. I had been victorious. 2 days passed, and he appointed me not a norm setter, but much higher, works manager. In other words, I was senior to the work assigner, chief of all the brigadiers. I had got out of the frying pan into the fire. There had been no such post before I came there. That showed what a loyal dog I had looked to him to be, and what a one Nevezhin would have made of me, too. But once again my career fell through. God saved me. That same week Nevezhin was removed from his post for stealing building materials. He had a very powerful personality, possessed an almost hypnotic stare, and he did not even have to raise his voice for the whole line-up to listen to him in trepidation. On grounds both of age, he was over 50, and of camp experience and his own cruelty, he ought long since to have been an NKVD general, and they said he had in fact already been a lieutenant colonel. However, he could not overcome his passion for stealing. He was never arrested because he was one of their own, but instead was merely removed from duty for a time and each time reduced in rank. And now he hadn't even been able to hold on to the rank of junior lieutenant either. Lieutenant Mironov, who replaced him, didn't have the patience to train anyone, and I myself could not get it into my head that what they wanted was for me to be a crushing hammer. Mironov turned out to be dissatisfied with me in every way, and he was even annoyed with and rejected my energetic reports. "You don't even know how to write. You have a clumsy style." And he held out to me the report by Pavlov, the foreman. "Here's a man who knows how to write. On analyzation of certain facts of reduction of fulfillment of plans, there is, 1, insufficient quantity of construction materials. 2, because of incomplete supply with tools of the brigades. 3, upon insufficient organization of work on the side of technical personnel. 4, and also safety precautions are not being observed." The value of this style was that the work management was to blame for everything, and the camp administration for nothing. Incidentally, this Pavlov, a former tank officer, who still went around in his helmet, had a similar way of talking. "If you understand about love, then prove to me what's love." He was discussing a familiar subject. He was unanimously praised by the women who had been intimate with him. In camp, this sort of thing is not kept very secret. The second week there, I was demoted in disgrace to general work, and in my place they appointed that same Vasya Pavlov. Since I had not contested with him for the place, and had not resisted my ouster, he sent me out not with a shovel, but with a painter's brigade. The whole brief history of my leadership did, however, secure me an advantage in living conditions. As works manager, I was housed in a special trustee's room, one of the two privileged rooms in the camp. And Pavlov was already living in the other such room, and when I was dismissed, no worthy claimant turned up for my cot, and for several months I continued to live on there. And at the time I valued only the better living conditions in this room. Instead of multiple bunks, there were ordinary cots and one bed table for every two persons, not for a whole brigade. During the day the door was locked and you could leave your things there. Last, there was a half-legal electric hot plate, and it was not necessary to go and crowd around the big common stove in the yard. Slave of my oppressed and frightened body, I valued only this at the time. But now, when I have an urge to write about my neighbors in that room, I realize what its principal advantage was. Never again in my life, either through personal inclination or in the social labyrinth, would I get close to such people as Air Force General Belyayev and the MVD man Zinoviev, who, if not a general, was close to it. I now know that a writer cannot afford to give in to feelings of rage, disgust, or contempt? Did you answer someone in a temper? If so, you didn't hear him out and lost track of his system of opinions. You avoided someone out of disgust, and a completely unknown personality slipped out of your ken, precisely the type you would have needed some day. But, however tardily, I nonetheless caught myself and realized I had always devoted my time and attention to people who fascinated me and were pleasant, who engaged my sympathy, and that as a result I was seeing society like the moon, always from one side. But just as the moon, as it swings slightly back and forth, libration, shows us a portion of its dark side too, so that chamber of monstrosities disclosed people unknown to me. Air Force Major General Alexander Ivanovich Belyayev, everyone in camp still called him General, was invariably noticed by every new arrival on the first day in the first lineup. He stood out from the whole blackish-grey, lousy camp column, not only in height and bearing, but because of his excellent leather coat, no doubt foreign-made, of a kind you would not see on the street in Moscow. The people who wore them ride about in automobiles, and even more because of his particular air of non-presence. Even without stirring in the camp column, he was able to demonstrate that he had no relationship whatever to all that camp rabble swarming about him, that he would even die without realizing how he had come to be there. Stretched to his full height, he looked over the heads of the mob, just as if he were reviewing a completely different parade which we could not see. And when the trooping out began and the guard at the gatehouse whacked a board across the backs of the Zeks on the outside and the departing fives, Belyayev, in the Brigade of Work Trustees, tried never to be the one on the end. If he did happen to get there, then he squeamishly shuddered and bent down as he went past the gatehouse, showing by his whole back how he held the gatehouse sentry in contempt, and the latter did not dare to touch him. While I was still Work's manager, in other words, an important chief, I became acquainted with the general in the following way. In the construction office where he was working as assistant norm setter, I noticed that he was smoking, and I approached him to get a light from his cigarette. I politely asked his permission, and had already bent over his desk in readiness. With a sharp gesture, Belyayev jerked his cigarette from in front of mine, as though fearing I might infect it, got out an expensive chrome-plated lighter, and placed it down before me. It was easier for him to let me soil and spoil his lighter than to lower himself by holding his cigarette for me. I was embarrassed. And whenever anyone was impudent enough to ask him for a light from his cigarette, he always placed his expensive lighter in front of him the same way, thus crushing him completely and dispelling any desire to approach him a second time. And if anyone managed to catch him at the very moment when he himself was lighting up with his lighter, and hastened to shove a cigarette toward him, he calmly blew out the lighter, closed its top, and placed it, like that, in front of the person approaching. This gave them to understand the whole magnitude of his sacrifice, and if there was no one else from whom to get a light, all the free foremen and prison brigadiers who swarmed in the office went outdoors in the courtyard to get one, rather than to him. Housed in the same room with him now, and with our cots, in fact, side by side, I was able to discover that squeamishness, disdain, and irritation were the principal feelings possessing him in his situation as a prisoner. Not only did he never go to the camp mess hall, I don't even know where the door to it is, but he wouldn't let our neighbor, Prokhorov, bring him anything from the camp slops, except his bread ration. Was there any other Zek in the archipelago who could have so mocked his poor bread ration? Belyayev took it gingerly like a dirty toad, for you see it had been touched by hands and carried on wooden trays, and trimmed it with his knife on all six sides, cutting off both the crust and the dough as well. These six cut-off pieces he never gave to those who asked for them, to Prokhorov or the old man orderly, but threw them in the slop bucket. Once I was even so bold as to ask him why he did not give them to Prokhorov. He proudly threw back his head, his white hair cropped very short. He wore his hair so short that it would seem both a hairstyle and a camp haircut. My cellmate at the Lubyanka once asked me, "Please let me finish your soup. I was nearly sick to my stomach. I react very painfully to human humiliation." He refused bread to the hungry so as not to humiliate them. The general was able to preserve all this haughtiness with such ease because there was a trolleybus number 4 stop near the gatehouse. Every day at 1 p.m. when we returned from the work compound to the residence compound for lunch, the general's wife would descend from a trolleybus at the outer gatehouse, bringing a hot meal in thermoses, cooked just an hour before in the general's kitchen at home. On weekdays they were not permitted to meet, and the thermoses were handed over by the turnkey. But on Sundays they spent half an hour together at the gatehouse. They said his wife always left in tears. Alexandra Ivanovich took out on her everything that had accumulated in his proud and suffering soul in the course of a week. Belyayev made one accurate observation. In camp, it is impossible to keep things or foodstuffs simply in a box or simply under lock and key. The box has to be a steel box and bolted to the floor. But from this there followed the conclusion. Out of 100 people in camp, 80 are scoundrels. He didn't say 95, so as not to lose all his listeners. If I should ever meet anyone from in here, out in freedom, and that person should rush up to me, I would say, you are insane, I have never met you before. How I suffer from barracks living, he said. This with only 6 people there. If only I could eat by myself, locked in, alone. Was he hinting that we ought to go out while he ate? He especially wanted to eat alone. Was it because what he ate today was incomparable with what others ate, or was it simply out of his own circle's established custom of hiding their bounty from the hungry? On the other hand, he loved to talk with us, and it is highly unlikely that he would really have liked to be in a separate room. But the way he liked to talk was one-sided, loudly, self-confidently, and only about himself. They offered me another camp with more comfortable conditions. I can quite well picture that they do offer such as him a choice. That never happens to me. Do you know, when I was in the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan... But nothing of any interest at all came after that, just some sort of nonsense to provide some kind of justification for that resounding introduction. When I was in the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan... He had really been around and seen sights. He was less than 50 and was still good and strong. There was just one strange thing. He was an Air Force Major General, but he never talked about a single battle flight, not even one single flight. And yet, judging by his own account, he was the head of our Air Force purchasing mission in the United States during the war. America had evidently astonished him, and he managed to buy a lot there, too. He never lowered himself to explain to us what precisely he had been arrested for, but evidently it was in connection with this American trip or his stories about it. Otsep proposed the path of complete confession. A well-known Soviet lawyer. In other words, he seconded the interrogator. But I said, I would rather have my term doubled, but I am guilty of nothing. One can readily believe that as far as the government was concerned, he was innocent of any guilt. They gave him not a double, but a half term, 5 years, when even 16-year-old chatterboxes got more than that. Looking at him and listening to him, I used to think, this is what he is like now, after the rough fingers had torn his shoulder boards off. I can just picture how he had cringed. After the body searches, after the boxes, after the black mariahs, after hands behind your backs. He did not allow himself to be contradicted even in petty things, let alone in big things. Big things he would not even have discussed with us since we were unworthy, except for Zinoviev. But not once did I ever see him absorb any thought he himself had not expressed. He was simply incapable of accepting any argument. He knew everything before we spoke. What had he been like earlier as head of the purchasing mission, a Soviet envoy to the West? A polished, white-faced, impenetrable sphinx, a symbol of the new Russia, as they understood it in the West. What would it have been like to approach him with a request, or to shove your head into his office with a request? How he would have barked, how he'd come down on you. It would have explained a lot if he had come from a long line of military men, but he hadn't. These Himalayas of self-assurance had been mastered by a Soviet general of the first generation. During the Civil War in the Red Army, he was probably a young fellow in bast sandals who couldn't sign his name. How had all this come into being so swiftly? He had always been in an elite circle, even aboard trains, even at resorts, always with those of his own group, behind the iron gates where entrance was permitted only with passes. And what about the others? more likely to be like him than different? And what would happen if the truth that the sum of the angles of a triangle is equal to 180 degrees were to threaten their private residences, their ranks, their assignments abroad? In that case, they would cut off your head for drawing a triangle. Triangular pediments would be knocked off all houses. A decree would be issued that angles henceforth were to be measured in radians. And once again, I thought, what about me? Why couldn't they have made the same sort of general out of me in the course of 20 years? Of course they could have. And once again, I looked closely. Alexander Ivanovich was not at all a bad chap. When he read Gogol, he laughed warmly, and he used to make us all laugh when he was in a good mood. He had an intelligent laugh. If I had wanted to nourish hatred for him in myself, there, when we were lying next to one another on our cots, I could not have done it. The way was not closed for him to become a fully good person, but only through suffering. Through suffering. Pavel Nikolaevich Zinoviev didn't go to the camp mess hall either, and also would have liked to arrange things so that he had his meals brought to him in thermos jugs. It was a bitter pill to swallow, to be left behind Belyayev, to turn out to be on a lower rung. But his circumstances were more difficult. Belyayev had not been punished by confiscation of his property, whereas Zinoviev had been subjected to partial confiscation. His money, his savings accounts, had evidently all been hauled in and taken from him, and all that was left him was a good, rich apartment. And how he used to love to talk about that apartment, time and time again, at great length, smacking his lips over every detail of the bath, realizing what enjoyment we must be getting from his story. He even had a saying of his own, "After 40, a man's value is determined by his apartment." He used to recount all this in Belyayev's absence, because Belyayev would not even have listened to him, but would have started telling stories about himself instead, although not about his apartment, for he considered himself an intellectual, but perhaps about the Sudan again. But according to Pavel Nikolaevich, his wife was ill and his daughter was obliged to work, and there was no one to bring him any thermoses. However, even the food parcels he received on Sundays were modest, and he was forced to bear his situation with the pride of an impoverished nobleman. Nonetheless, he did not go to the mess hall, disdaining the filth there and the mass of chomping rabble. But he used to ask Prokhorov to bring both the gruel and the cereal to the room, where he warmed them up on the hot plate. He would willingly have cut 6 sides off the bread ration, too, but he had no other bread, and he therefore limited himself to holding his bread ration over the hot plate, burning from all 6 sides the microbes implanted there by the hands of the bread cutters and Prokhorov. He did not go to the mess hall, and could even on occasion renounce his gruel. But he didn't have enough blue-blooded pride to restrain himself from petty begging in the room. "Could I just try a tiny piece? I haven't eaten any of that for a long time." On the whole, he was exaggeratedly gentle and polite, till something rubbed him the wrong way. His politeness was particularly notable besides Belyayev's unnecessary rudeness. Inwardly restrained, outwardly restrained, with a deliberate way of chewing and cautious movements, he was the genuine Chekhov character, the man in the case. So true to life that there is no need to describe the rest of it, he was just as in Chekhov, except that he was not a schoolteacher, but an MVD general. It was impossible to use the electric hot plate even for a second during those minutes Pavel Nikolaevich had set aside for himself. Beneath his snake-like stare, you just jerked your mess tin off the hot plate immediately, and if you hadn't, he would have ticked you off pronto. During the lengthy Sunday daytime roll calls in the courtyard, I used to try to take a book out with me, always about physics, keeping as far from literature as possible. And I hid behind the backs of those in front and read. Oh, what torment this violation of discipline gave Pavel Nikolaevich. You see, I was reading in formation, in sacred formation. And by doing this, I was stressing my own challenge, flaunting my insolence. He didn't attack me directly, but stared at me in such a way and squirmed in such torment, so groaned and grunted, that all the other trustees were sick of my reading too. So in the end I had to renounce my book, and stand there like an idiot for an hour at a time. And you couldn't read in the room, you had to listen to the stories. Once, one of the girl bookkeepers from the construction office was late at line-up,
and thereby held up the departure of the trusty brigade to the work compound 5 minutes. And so, instead of being led out at the head of the column, our brigade was put at the end.
This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette.